field theory, and the problem is related to fine tuning. And you remember we said, okay, so the Higgs is light. That's what the data seems to indicate. And we know that if we just put by hand a two-level mass for the Higgs, we have to account for the quantum corrections that show up. And these quantum corrections go as lambda, the scale of new physics, squared. So if the Higgs talks to any new physics at high scales, it's going to get a shift in the mass that is very large. So to keep the Higgs mass pretty light, we really need a very, very fine-tuned cancellation between these two terms. This is the problem of fine-tuning. Now, what is this scale of new physics? You could imagine that you want the Higgs theory to be valid all the way to the Planck scale. So the scale of new physics could be the Planck scale. Whereas, so that will mean that the mass of the Higgs is order n Planck, naturally. Whereas we know that the mass of the Higgs is actually order the electroweak scale. So another way of posing the problem of this scalar theory is to say that what is unnatural is that we have such high scales above the electroweak scale. If there was no physics, there was nothing beyond the electroweak scale, we would be fine. There will be a meaning of the mass of the Higgs to be order the electroweak scale. So sometimes the fine-tuning problem is expressed as the gauge hierarchy problem. Why is the electroweak scale so low compared with the scale of gravitational interactions? Why is gravity so weak with respect to electroweak interactions? So the fine-tuning problem and the gauge hierarchy problem are related in that way. So there is an obvious solution to this problem. Can you imagine what is the solution? The problem is that we are trying to describe physics in very different scales. The problem is that the Planck scale is so large and the gravitational interactions are so weak. Do you see a way to solve this problem? Tutors can talk. Yeah, you can. Okay, but then if we put any scales in between, it will reintroduce the problem. Right? The Higgs will pick each of these scales and increase and increase in mass.
Yeah, but it doesn't have to be a perturbative
scale. And then this whole discussion is really talking. I mean, this whole discussion, I did it using loops, but it's actually just dimensional analysis. So if the Higgs talks to new scales, just by that mass dimensions, the correction must go as this new scale square unless there is a symmetry protecting it. So I understand that we were talking about loops, but doesn't seem to rely on perturbativity. Like one very silly way you want is to say, okay, actually there is no such thing as the Planck scale. The Planck scale doesn't exist. What happens is that we see gravitational interactions as being very, very weak for other reasons. For example, the existence of new extra dimensions of space and time. So in reality, all the scales are tied up to be exactly the same, the electroweak scale, and there is no fine-tuning problem anymore. Yes?
Why is it such a problem that why do we care that gravity is weak?
Ah, okay. So it is not about caring about, like, the idea is that above the Planck scale, you know that you should treat gravity quantum mechanically. We don't have any clue about how to do that. So the best you can do is to describe the Higgs physics up to the Planck scale. So there is a natural cutoff for your quantum field theory. This is the Planck scale. That's why we care. So the problem that the Higgs is facing is that here is the electroweak scale, here is the Planck scale, and if you run the mass of the Higgs all the way to the Planck scale, the Higgs keeps picking up corrections and corrections. So one idea is that this Planck scale is actually down in the electroweak scale. This is the idea of large extra dimensions. And also the idea of world extra dimensions. It's what you think is a very weak coupling, and you relate that to a very large scale, is actually not the scale itself, but the coupling. And we will talk about all these things later. So one simple way out is to just get rid of this Planck scale and send the Planck scale to the electroweak scale. All right, so you got two new concepts, the fine-tuning and the gauge hierarchy problem. So many proposals for beyond the standard model are precisely trying to solve this fine-tuning problem or the gauge hierarchy problem. Supersymmetry is precisely doing that. Now, this is one of the problems, and let's see what are the strategies to solve this kind of problems. So one strategy is using dynamics. And one example of a dynamical solution for the fine-tuning problem is called, or is based on something called dimensional transmutation. Okay, the idea is that if you have a classical field theory with no scales, so imagine I have a lambda phi 4 theory with no mass, or I just have a gauge theory. When I renormalize this theory, so in the quantum field theory, breaks the scale invariance with the classical scale invariance. And that's the reason why when you renormalize the theory, you start seeing things like the gauge coupling runs with the scale, or the mass runs with the scale, and so on and so on. Okay. So sometimes this breaking is very important. For example, when essentially what you're seeing is a theory without the scales, may end up having a quantum theory with a new scale. And this scale is dynamically generated by quantum effects. So I'm going to give you a couple of examples. Let's take QCD, quantum chromodynamics. So I guess you saw some of it during Michael's course, right? So it's the theory of external interactions with massless fermions. You know that this theory, when you describe it like this, that it has no scales, but you end up finding globals. So a theory that is described with no dimension-full parameters dynamically generates these bound states, which have a particular scale. So what dimensional transmutation is telling you in this case is that I start with a coupling, dimensionless, then I renormalize it, and I introduce some kind of scale dependence. And I can trade when the coupling explodes with a particular scale. And in the case of the QCD, is just lambda QCD, the typical scale for glue balls. So you see, this is a completely non-perturbative phenomena. This is dynamics. This is very difficult to describe using analytical tools. But the idea is that some strong dynamics are able to trade just simple or dimensionless couplings into a particular scale at which the strong dynamics shows up. Okay? So describing this dynamics in detail is very difficult. You can ask Mark. He works on lattice gauge theories, and this is what he does every day. He's trying to describe this kind of phenomena, how these resonances show up, where are the typical mass separations, and things like this. So this is pretty difficult. Okay. Yes?
Will you explain a bit what are these glue balls?
The glue balls is just so you have the gauge fields, and they form bound states. So you want this bound state of the gauge field. They get a vacuum expectation value and they produce these resonances. So the scale at which they get this expectation value is more or less the mass for this glue box. On the same token as mesons and baryons are just bound states of quarks. So even in a theory with massless fermions, no mass scales, you end up generating dynamically a scale.
Do you need the fermions to generate the glue ball states?
No.
Okay.
No, because if you look at the beta function for QCD, at least at one look, you see that the fermions are not helping at all on the strong dynamics. They are reducing it, so. Just a pure gauge theory. Yeah, you're very good. And there are other examples. One of them, famous one, is the Coleman-Weinberg potential. Have you heard about that? No? Okay. Another example is you take a lambda 5-hole theory with no mass term. You can compute a one loop, what is called the Coleman-Weinberg potential. Do you want contributions of this kind? And then you will see how this potential generates a new scale. In the homework tomorrow, we are going to talk about Gorston bosons. Gorston bosons are particles that don't have any potential of any kind, so they are really scale invariant. And the way to use these Gorston bosons for phenomenology is precisely giving them some kind of potential, generating a potential perturbatively using Coleman-Weinberg potentials. So that this is related to that. You did? Oh, okay. Okay. That's cool. All right. So the summary of all this dimensional transmutation, and we are going to see more about dimensional transmutation in the Technicolor chapter, so don't worry, we'll come back. I know it's a little bit difficult right now. So the idea is that if the dynamics behind an electroweak symmetry breaking, so the Higgs sector is confining, then you can think on the Higgs not as an elementary particle, but actually as a bound state. And on the same way, the glue ball bound state mass is dynamically generated and really doesn't care about Planck scales. So this guy has its own infrared physics. The glue ball shows up because there is some coupling blowing up at some scale. So it really doesn't care about what's going on at Planck scales. So the glue ball is protected from ultraviolet divergences. So if the Higgs was the presence of the Higgs was related to the same kind of strong dynamics, it will mean that the Higgs is natural and there is no fine-tuning problem. So you have a gauge theory, and at some scale this gauge theory becomes very strong. The coupling becomes very strong. So you have the gluons, right, of your SU3. And they are so tightly coupled to each other that they form bound states, the same way that quarks, antiquarks may form bound states. Okay? So these bound states, you call them glue balls, they are made up of gauge fields. But you never see a gauge field in a glue ball free by itself, but they are always forming these bound states. So the scale at which all this physics is happening is precisely setting the mass for the glue balls.
Okay. So it's at the low energy scale of things where you get glue balls because of asymptotic freedom at high energies.
So, well, you could go from a theory that is confining to confining again, but QCD happens to be asymptotic free at high energies and runs to a very strong coupling at low energies. So when that happens, you go from a description in terms of quarks and gluons, perturbative, everything is simple, to a description where the degrees of freedom are completely different. There are no quarks, there are no gluons, there are glue balls, there are mesons, and there are baryons. It's a completely different physics. The transition from the free quark gluon plasma you want to this kind of physics is leading to this dimensional transmutation. I start with just a dimensionless coupling and I ended up generating dynamically a new scale, the scale of this phase transition. So imagine that electroweak symmetry breaking is actually something similar. And we have some kind of confining physics. Confining meaning that these gluons or gauge fields are no longer able to freely propagate, but they are really confined inside the glue balls. That's what it means. So imagine that the Higgs is not just a simple elementary particle, but it's a bound state of other stuff. In that case, what is setting the mass of the Higgs is not the ultraviolet physics. The Higgs is not picking up any ultraviolet contributions. It's really just set by the scale of the phase transition.
So these we don't have a hierarchy problem here, it's just because the hierarchy problem is associated with having a fundamental scalar field.
Yes.
So we say, well, we don't have a fundamental scalar field.
Exactly.
We have bound states of fermions. Can it be fermions or spinors?
It could be either way, yes. As long as they produce a scalar at the end of the day.
So that we know that spinor has been one of nice.
Exactly. So the idea will be, the idea of Technicolor is that there is no fundamental scalar. This is rubbish. The only things that make sense in quantum field theory are fermions and gauge bosons. And we are going to make up a new scalar degree of freedom that is going to be a bound state of fermions, for example. This is the same as in superconductivity. So in the superconducting phase, you have this pair, Cooper pairs, that made up of electrons, and they behave as bosons. But they are not elementary bosons, they are just a bound state of electrons. So this is a very simple and elegant way of solving the fine-tuning problem. It's just, your guess is that you shouldn't believe a theory, a scalar theory, at very high scales. There is no such a thing. On the other hand, because this scale is generated dynamically with the strong interactions, then we have to ask Mark to run the simulations. And physics becomes very complicated. All right. So that's one way. And this is the way of Technicolor, and also the way of work extra dimensions. So when we see these guys, you will We will talk again about the Higgs as a bound state. Okay. So now we go for the more common way. Instead of talking about dynamics, we are going to talk about symmetries. Symmetries is the way of the standard model, and you know the standard model works very well, so at least this is something you know works. So the first thing I'm going to do is to explain to you the different types of symmetries and the different ways of breaking them. All right. So the symmetries is the standard model way. So maybe beyond the standard model is also based on symmetries. You know what is a symmetry? A symmetry is a transformation of the fields that keeps physics invariant. And thanks to Emil Noether, we know that a symmetry leads to a conserved current. And this conserved current leads to conserved charges and leads to physical laws. And leads to selection rules, for example. For example, we know that the neutron, which is electrically neutral, has to decay into, if it decays into charged particles, they have to have the opposite sign. Why? Because we know that electric charge is conserved in the universe. And you can express this conservation as a conserved current, the electromagnetic current. All right, so this is a symmetry. It's a transformation of the fields that leaves physics invariant. So a transformation of fields could be something like this. I go from the field to the same field, but now I rotate this field with this exponential guy. This is called the generator of the symmetry. This, if you want, this is the way you characterize your symmetry. And this is just a parameter. That tells you how this the magnitude of this rotation. So if epsilon is a constant with a space and time, then you call this symmetry global, meaning that the value of the transformation is the same everywhere in space and time. If epsilon has some dependence on x, nu, then you call this symmetry gauge. So formally, the transformation look very similar, but the physics of global symmetries and gauge symmetries is very different. All right. So we know that we have global and gauge symmetries, and let's see how we can break them. The first type of breaking is called spontaneous. Well, no, let me do the simplest one first. Explicit breaking. Explicit breaking is just saying I have a Lagrangian and actually contains a part in the Lagrangian preserves the symmetry, but there are other parts in the Lagrangian that are breaking the symmetry. This is the explicit breaking of the symmetry preserved by this part of the Lagrangian. If this is much, it's just a perturbation, on this other part of the Lagrangian, then you call this explicit breaking an approximate symmetries. So you say that the symmetry is approximate, meaning that the breaking is a small is the breaking is done with a small parameter. Right? Okay. So this is explicit breaking and what is called an approximate symmetry. What it means is that you can do to first order your physics assuming that the symmetry is preserved and then perturb using this explicit breaking. The second way of breaking symmetries is spontaneously. The idea that the Lagrangian is still symmetric, it preserves the symmetry, but the vacuum is not. So you can break spontaneously global and gauge symmetries, and the results are pretty different, so let's do that. So still on the spontaneous breaking, we are going to break global and gauge symmetries. Spontaneous symmetry breaking of global symmetries. It's very interesting because there is a theorem, it's Goldstone theorem. That tells you that when there is a spontaneous breaking of a global symmetry, there is a massless degree of freedom per broken generator. If you've never seen that, look at Michael's book or somewhere and have a look at the derivation of this theorem. It's a very simple derivation. It just says that when you break spontaneously a global symmetry to another global symmetry or to nothing, no global symmetry at all, for each generator that you've broken, you will end up with, in the low energy theory, with a massless degree of freedom, a massless scalar. So, for example, you know in massless QCD, QCD with massless fermions, I told you yesterday that when fermions are massless, there is an extra symmetry, chiral symmetry. So, in QCD, this chiral symmetry is SUNF. There's UNF, where NF is the number of flavors, the number of massless fermions, and you have a chiral symmetry for all the left guys and a chiral symmetry for all the right guys. So this chiral symmetry is spontaneously broken to SUNF, what is called vector. So you start with a lot of global symmetry. The chiral symmetry breaking leads to this smaller symmetry. So for each generator that has been broken here, you will end up with a massless fermion, massless scalar. So these massless scalars, in this case, are the pions and the kaons. And we've seen these guys. So the description of pions and kaons based on this picture of spontaneous symmetry breaking is very accurate, which is giving strength on the Goldstone theorem. Now let's talk about breaking spontaneously gauge symmetries. Yes? Right? And this mass is much, much smaller than the typical mass of the QCD resonances. So you just look at the typical scale of QCD resonances, the pions and kaons look massless. And the way you, so you are very right, ions and kaons are massive. And the way you describe their masses and the masses being so small is because you are an explicit breaking on top of the spontaneous breaking. And yesterday we talked about technically natural. Because there is this enhanced symmetry, when the mass of the pions and kaons is zero, it makes sense, or it is technically natural to have very light pions and kaons, even when you are explicit breaking.
Can you explain the breaking of the two acid and the...
Yes, so how many generators are here? Like, I don't know if you've done that before. Okay. Nf squared minus 1. And you have two of them, so you have two. And you end up with Nf squared minus 1. So I start with these generators. I only conserve this one, so the difference will be the number of Goldstone bosons I'm going to end up with.
But the question is, what, how does the symmetry actually act?
Oh, okay. Yes. Yes. So the reason why this symmetry, this chiral symmetry that is protecting the mass of the quarks, right, is broken spontaneously is because these combinations, UU bar plus DV bar, end up getting a vacuum expectation value. So the, although the Lagrangian is still invariant under the symmetry, the vacuum isn't. And that's the spontaneous symmetry.
How does the field transform under
this
original symmetry?
This is the, so tomorrow's homework.
Oh, actually, I can't say
it. Yeah, so tomorrow we are going to do a kind of simpler example. We are going to look at the Goldstone bosons and we are going to describe how they transform under the broken and unbroken symmetries. That's going to be tomorrow. Okay, so let's move into the spontaneous symmetry breaking of gauge symmetry. So you probably heard from Michael that it, you just take a gauge, a spin one theory, and add by hand a mass term for this guy. Let's say the photon, I just add an explicit breaking of the U1 symmetry. It's not only like you're breaking it explicitly, but worse than that, you are screwing up with the renormalizability of the theory. So it is very tough to imagine how the W's and Z's who started being massless gauge bosons end up with masses. And it took a very long time to really figure out how can we end up with massive gauge bosons and not screw up the whole theory. The way to do that is a spontaneous symmetry breaking. The reason is that although the vacuum breaks the symmetry, the Lagrangian is still invariant. And when you renormalize the Lagrangian, you have to take the Lagrangian and then that a bunch of counter terms. That a theory is renormalizable means that this the number of counter terms is finite. Seen that ever? No? Okay, so it's finite. And because you are breaking the symmetry spontaneously, the Lagrangian is still invariant, so this still holds. So you want breaking spontaneously a gauge symmetry is fantastic because there is a secret renormalizability. So you can succeed in giving masses to W's and Z's and still keep the nice features of having a gauge theory that is renormalizable. Alright. So one possible description on the of the breaking spontaneous breaking of gauge symmetries is thinking that actually the Goldstone bosons that you generate in this breaking are eaten by the gauge bosons. That's the way we explain that. So you start with a massless W or Z bosons. So a massless spin one field has 2 degrees of freedom, right? And we call these degrees of freedom transverse polarizations. Transverse polarizations. But when they can become massive, they had to obtain a longitudinal polarization. So when you go from massless to massive, W and Z, you need to obtain a new degree of freedom. You have to go from 2 degrees of freedom to 3 degrees of freedom. You can view that as the gauge boson is eating some of the Goldstone bosons created during the symmetry breaking. So these kind of Goldstone bosons that will be eaten by somebody else sometimes are called will be Goldstone bosons, because they will be Goldstone bosons if they weren't eaten. Simple as that. Okay. And then the last type of symmetries are accidental symmetries. Accidental. So imagine that you have a Lagrangian that contains several sectors. Let's say that this Lagrangian is the one of the standard model, and you can think on the QED part and the electroweak part. The part involving the photon and the part involving the electroweak interactions, the W and the Z. So the idea of an accidental symmetry is that it is a symmetry of part of the Lagrangian, but it's not a symmetry of the whole Lagrangian. For example, CP is an accidental symmetry in the standard model because it's a symmetry of QED, but it is not a symmetry of electroweak interactions. All right, so that's it in terms of symmetries. The good thing is that all these symmetries and symmetry breakings already appear in the standard model. So we know they are there. In the standard model, we have accidental symmetries. We have approximate symmetries, global symmetries that are spontaneously broken, and gauge symmetries that are spontaneously broken.
The only difference between an accidental symmetry and approximate symmetry is that approximate is controlled by some small
parameter. Exactly. Okay. So it's something you can tune away. Right. All right, so you see this chapter about the rational is a lot of new words, if you want, new concepts. But the bottom line is there is this inconsistency of having a scalar theory in quantum field theory. The Higgs is a scalar, so we had to deal with that. Either we say there is no Higgs, there is some other new physics that doesn't involve the Higgs, or we had to deal with the fine-tuning and the gauge hierarchy problem. Okay. So, you have any questions? Then we are going to move towards confronting data. That's you want the challenge of all the BSM, beyond the standard model proposals. Like, you can have a beautiful model, but it's just data is killing me. So we are going to confront data. And I guess here I should stop a little bit and tell you something you know already. You know that physics is not the same thing as math. We love math, we do a lot of math, but it's not math. And the reason is that physics is an empirical science. And the object of study of this empirical science is nature, is our physical reality. It is not an imaginary world, and we cannot choose or decide what we want as reality. It is here, and that's the subject of study of physics. And because it's an empirical science, when you write down your very beautiful ideas, first thing you have to do is to make sure that it is consistent with the existing data. Oops, sorry. But what is more important, well, it's also very, very important to keep in mind, is that it has to be falsifiable. I can always sit down and spend my life working on a very nice theory, very beautiful in terms of mathematics, but if it's not falsifiable, I don't care, right? It's like religious belief. So we have to confront data. First, I'm going to give you a big overview of the kind of solutions you engineer to avoid confronting data, and then we will talk about data itself. So the first way of avoiding data is to say, okay, my tags or constraints are direct detection, so I build this machine, I put detectors around, and I haven't seen any new physics, so it must be that this new physics has not been produced, or it was produced, but the backgrounds were too high. So direct detection means, well, for example, at LEP, an E plus and E minus collided, they produce a Z, and my Z could decay into new physics. That will be a direct detection constraint. The other types of constraints are called indirect, of course. And it means that, for example, at LEP, I had so much data, and it was so precise, that I knew my parameters here to the percent level. With this type of accuracy, I'm sensitive to any kind of loop effects here. So although I'm not producing a physical new physics particle, the effects on loops of this kind of new physics are going to show up in LEP data. So that imposes a lot of constraints as well. And this is called indirect. So for example, they can come from LEP, from loops of this kind, or they can also come from flavor physics. So I could imagine that my new physics is able to do a B to S gamma decay. So the B hadron decays into an S quark and a photon. And this decay is mediated by loops of new physics. Those are indirect because I'm really not producing new physics and then as a final state. I'm just producing it in loops. So the usual ways to avoid these constraints are two ways. One way is kinematics. Kinematics is, okay, I send everything so heavy that it's not giving me any type of constraint, so it's just pushing the new physics scale to very high scales. So the effects decouple. And that's boring because it brings this theory to be non-falsifiable. The other way is, for example, using symmetries. Again, symmetries. Always to save the day. One of the problems of producing new physics is that it could be that new physics is able to be singly produced. So let's say I have the Z, and I get a Z prime, and another Z. And if I produce that at the LEP collider, it is very simple to produce this Z prime because this guy is heavy, but I'm producing it with another light guy. Whereas if I had a way to forbid this kind of decays and just allow pair production, then I will be in good shape, because it is harder to produce two heavy guys than just one of them. So how do we do that? We can use asymmetry. A Z2 symmetry. It's called a parity. And you say that under this Z2 symmetry, the standard model is even, and new physics is odd. And because you want this symmetry to be preserved, then diagrams like this are not allowed, because this is even, even, and odd. So this coupling is odd, and it violates the Z2 symmetry. Whereas this kind of coupling, which is even, odd, odd, is fine. So by imposing a parity, you can make sure that there will be no single production of new physics. And the only way to produce it is pair production. And that buys you some time. Okay, so that's one way. Another way of using symmetries to avoid constraints is assuming that the flavor structure of your new physics is very similar to the standard model. This kind of assumption is called minimal flavor violation. It means I allow for some flavor violation beyond the standard model, but I make things so similar to the standard model that these new theories of beyond the standard model are still allowed. All right. Questions about that? Okay, so our main problem is that we need to write down a new model beyond the standard model, and we know the standard model works so well with data that there is only a finite amount of possibilities. So one way of buying time, if you want, is to assume this kind of parity and to assume that the flavor structure is very, very simple. It's called minimal flavor violation. And we know how to see how to create.
So how would you change the angles, Lagrangian, to make those differences clear?
So you mean between the standard model and beyond the standard model? Yes, okay, that's good. So we are going to do examples of that. We are going to talk about supersymmetry, Randerson, Pernicola, and so on and so forth. And most of them implement these kind of ideas. They have a parity, and they assume minimal flavor violation. So very often, so what is beyond the standard model? It's a set of new ideas, new particles, and new interactions. And these interactions are either leading to dynamics, like this dimensional transmutation, or to new symmetries. So you have to assume that what we already observe is there, the standard model is there, except the Higgs, this we haven't seen yet. But this other new physics has all these features. And then, once you are done with that, you have to move on and say, okay, so my theory is falsifiable because you must see this at this collider. Question?
No?
Okay. So when I say that existing data really favors the standard model, or the standard model works very well, you can take it as, okay, that means that the standard model is right. Or you can take it as data is very useful, a very useful guidance to write beyond the standard model sectors, because data is constraining a lot. So take it either way. So I don't know if with Michael you looked at the oblique corrections, STU parameters. Okay. So there's something called the electroweak position test. It's just a bunch of measurements mostly from LEP, the Large Electron Positron Collider, and they are very well measured to the percent level. So using all these measurements, you can constrain beyond the standard model theories. And what Michael and Takeuchi did a long time ago is to say, okay, there is a bunch of these electroweak precision tests. But we know that some of these tests are better than others. In particular, we know very well what's going on with the Z and the W, because LEP was running on those energies for a very long time, collecting data and doing precision measurements there. So we would like to, instead of talking about, I think it's 25 observables, we would like to have a very simple parametrization of effects of new physics. His parametrization was based on, let's look at the effects here and nowhere else. And those are called oblique corrections. Yes, doesn't have to be on the loop. It could be non-perturbative physics. And that's the way Michael, for example, killed a lot of technical role models. Yes. Anything that messes up with the Z and the W is going to be tightly constrained by LEP. So what Michael said is, okay, so let's find a parametrization of these effects. That is simple and theorists can use. So his parametrization is called the STU parameters. And I'm not going to explain them, those parameters. They are just related to the polarizations, to these diagrams for the Z and the W. But I'm going to give you the intuitive reasoning behind each of them. So the T parameter, for example, is a measurement. It's giving you a sense of the breaking of isospinning invariants. So I don't know how much you saw of isospin invariance, but essentially it's something that is messing up with this relation. The relation between the W and the Z masses, where this Weinberg angle is just a function of the SU2 left coupling and U1 hypercharged coupling. So any new physics that messes around with that is going to be constrained by the T parameter. The U parameter is kind of a loser because you can argue that the U is actually related to the T parameter in most models. The U is proportional to the electroweak scale, your scale of new physics, squared times the T parameter. So your theory is giving you trouble with the T parameter. There is no point in looking at the U because the U parameter is already this factor below. So if you have a model for beyond the standard model, it has to preserve its spin invariance. So it seems that we can keep the T parameter under control if we use symmetries. That's good, because we know symmetries, we can do that. So the big trouble comes with the S parameter. The S parameter is not protected by any symmetry. Roughly, what the S parameter is doing is counting how big is your new sector that affects the electroweak symmetry breaking. So the S parameter is a kind of counting the electroweak symmetry breaking sector. So if you have particles collaborating with electroweak symmetry breaking beyond the Higgs, you are going to obtain an S parameter, and you will be constrained by LEP data. And because there is no symmetry protecting the S, there is nothing you can do about that. So that's a big, big, big problem for Technicolor. And that's the way Michael was able to kill a lot of Technicolor models that look like QCD, for example. Right? Okay, so a little bit more. So those are electroweak precision tests. It's a bunch of observables. So these are observables, things that we can observe. But the STU, keep in mind, they are not observable. They are just a parametrization. So using data, you can constrain the value of SDU, and then you can compare with your model, but they are not really observables. Okay. So other kinds of data. You can have things like composite nest bounds. What it means is LEP and other machines are able to impose bounds on four fermion operators like this one. And they, what they do is to express their results, they do something, what is the condition? So imagine that I'm looking at all the events of E plus E minus that led to mu plus mu minus. So the this number of events can be restated as this number in front of this operator, four fermion operator, and that sets a bound on the scale of new physics. So these bounds are of order 10 TeV for most of them. What it means is that if there is beyond the standard model new physics that is able to generate this kind of four fermion operators, they are tightly bound. And even worse is the flavor bounds. There are also four fermion operators, but now the fermions are changing flavor, for example, operators of this kind. Using the Keon system, you can tell that lambda is bigger than 10 to the 3 TeV. So if your new physics is able to generate an operator like this one, the mass of this guy should be of order 1,000 TeV. Pretty falsifiable, non-falsifiable. All right. So there are indirect bounds, flavor bounds, and there are things like the Z invisible width. So how do we know that there are three neutrinos? It's because in LEP, E plus E minus collider, we created the Z. The Z decays into nu bar from time to time. And it does it to both the electron, the muon, and also the tau neutrino. So by looking at the branching ratio of the Z to these invisible particles, you can bound how many neutrinos are out there. So then you get that the value is 3.0 number, plus or minus some number with a 1% precision. So we know there are three neutrinos to a very high precision thanks to the invisible decays of the Z. So you have new physics that is coupled to the Z and is also invisible. Well, you can bound this new physics using this kind of thing. For example, in supersymmetry, we are going to see how there are new neutral fermions called the neutralinos. So if the Z was allowed to decay into the neutralinos, then it better be that this coupling is very, very small, because there is very little space for new species contributing to this invisible decay. So if you have new fermions or new scalar, sorry, neutral particles that couple to the Z, this is a way of bounding their mass. Other types of data are a little bit more complicated. For example, the forward backward asymmetry. And this, Ross can tell you, is becoming interesting these days because there is an anomaly at Tevatron in one of these asymmetries. What it is, for example, imagine that I have an E plus E minus machine and I produce two quarks, let's say fermion plus fermion minus. what the forward backward asymmetry is telling you is the relative difference between the movement of this guy and the movement of this other guy with the same charge. And it's expressed as this asymmetry is the forward minus backward over the sum, and I'm going to define what this is. This is a cross section, so it's a sigma. What this is I'm going to look at the production of these particles, and I will define the forward cross section as the you want how often the particle goes in the same direction, because I'm, and the backward, it will be exactly the same, but it will be how often this guy goes in the opposite direction. So sigma b is equals to pi, exactly the same thing. So by looking at these relative differences, you can obtain information about the structure of new physics, as in the case of the battery. Any depends on what is F. In the, so when you look at the electrobeam precision test, if you look at the forward backward asymmetry of the B quark, it seems to be 3 sigma of. So it's 3 sigma from the standard model prediction. But 3 sigma is just a hint. Yeah. Any question? Okay, so we are done with setting the evidence and the rationale for new physics. And next time, tomorrow, we are going to talk about supersymmetry, finally moving into some particular proposal.